and mechanical thumps against the cutter's outer hull. Amber light bathed the cockpit. I looked up into the glow outside, but saw little except a suggestion of dark gantries and cargo-lifting derricks. Another shudder. Betancourt threw a row of switches, and there was a whine as power feeds and auto systems wound down. He pushed back from the control deck and began pulling on his hide gloves. He smiled at me. "You needn't look so worried," he mocked. In truth, I am most disquieted by things I have no control over. Though I have rudimentary skills and can manage an atmospheric craft, I am no pilot, certainly not one with Midas's Glavian pedigree. That's why I employ him, and that's why he makes it look so easy. But sometimes my face betrays the alarm I feel in situations where I have no ability. Besides, I was tired. But I knew sleep wouldn't come even if I tried, and there was business to attend to anyway. Amos, Beckwin, and Loink would stay on the cutter for now. As soon as the hull door was closed and atmosphere recirculated into the SN's hold, I opened the hatch and stepped out with Fischig and Betancourt. The hold where we were docked was vaulted and immense. I reminded myself it was just one of six accommodated by this vessel. The surfaces of the walls and decking were oily black, and sodium lighting arrays bolted to the ceiling filled the place with orange-tinted luminescence. The spaces above us were busy with the skeletal shapes of cranes and monotask lifters, all shut down and lifeless. Packing materials littered the open floor. The gun cutter was held over the sealed floor hatch in a greased crib of docking pistons and hydraulic clamps. We crossed the hold, boots ringing on the metal deck plates. It was cold, the chill of open space still lingering. Betancourt wore his usual Glavian pilot suit and garish jacket. He was cheerful and whistled tunelessly. Fischig was impassive, oozing command in his brown RBT's uniform. He had fixed his golden sun disk of office to the breast of his jacket. I wore a dark sober suit of grey wool, black boots and gloves, and a long navy blue leather coat with a high collar. I had taken a stub pistol from the weapons locker and had it in a holster rig under my left arm. My inquisitorial rosette was buttoned away inside a pocket. Unlike Fischig, I felt no need to make a statement of authority. A hatch clanked open on servos, and light shone out from an internal companionway. A figure stepped out to meet us. "Welcome to the SN, Inquisitor," said Tobias Maxilla. Chapter 7. With the Master of the SN. A Farewell. Scrutiny. Maxilla was a veteran trader who had run the SN down the lanes from Thracian Primaris to the Grand Banks for 50 years. He told me he'd dealt in bulk consumables at the start of his career, then begun to specialize in exotic goods when the big bonded guilds began to dominate the wholesale market.
"The SN's got speed, a sprint trader. Pays me better to carry luxury cargoes and deliver them express, even if I don't run at capacity."
"You run this route regularly?"
"For the past few decades. It's seasonal. Sameter, Hesperus, Thracian, Hubris, Gudrun, sometimes to Messina, too. When Dormant finishes on Hubris, there'll be a lot more work there."
We sat in the luxurious surroundings of his audience suite, sipping vintage Amasek from large crystal glasses. Maxilla was showing off, but that was acceptable. He had a ship and a reputation to be proud of.
"So you know these routes well,"
Fischig put in. Maxilla smiled. He was a sinewy man of indeterminate age, dressed in a full-skirted coat of red velvet with wide button-back cuffs and an extravagant black lace cravat. His smile showed teeth that were inlaid with mother-of-pearl. Ostentation was common among ship's masters. It was part of showing off. "Forget family lineage and noble blood," one had told me once. "The lineage and pedigree of starships is where the new imperial nobility is to be found. Ship's masters were the real imperial aristocracy." So Maxilla seemed to think, anyway. His face was powdered with white skin dye, and he wore a sapphire as a beauty spot on his cheek. His imposing two-horned wig was spun from silver thread. Heavy signet rings clinked against his balloon glass as he lifted it.
"Yes, Chastener, I know them well."
"I don't think we need to start interrogating Master Maxilla yet, Fischig," I said plainly. Betancourt snorted, and Maxilla chuckled. Fischig glowered into his Amasek. a servitor, its torso and head casing wrought to resemble an antique ship's figurehead. A full-breasted damsel with gilt snakes in her hair hummed across the expensive Selgioni rug and offered us trays of delicacies. I took one, out of politeness. It was a sliver of perfect kettlefish, exquisitely sautéed and wrapped in a nearly transparent leaf of pastry. Bettencourt helped himself to several.
"You're a Glavian?"
Maxilla asked Bettencourt. The two promptly fell to discussing the merits of the famous Glavian longprow. I lost interest and looked around the suite. Amid the finery were a series of priceless portraits from the Sameter school, marble busts of planetary rulers, a Jacaro light sculpture, antique weapons and mounted suits of ceremonial mirror armour from Vitria. Amos would appreciate this, I thought. It was to be a journey of more than a week. I'd make sure he got a chance to see it.
"Do you know Gudrun?"
Maxilla was asking me. I shook my head. "This will be my first visit. I have only been in this subsector a year or so."
"A fine place, though you'll find it busy. There's a month-long festival underway to celebrate the founding of a new guard regiment. If you have the time, I recommend the Imperial Academy of Fine Arts and the Guild Museums in Dorset."
"I may be a little occupied." He shrugged.
"I always make the time to do more than simply work, Inquisitor. But I know your calling is rather more strenuous than mine."
I tried to get the measure of him, but I was failing so far. He had agreed to give us passage, and for a modest fee, considering what he might have demanded. I had already paid him with an imperial bond. Most ship masters don't like to turn down a request from an inquisitor, even if they are charging. Was it just that Maxilla wanted to keep sweet with the Ordos? Or was he simply a generous man? Or did he have something to hide? I wondered. Truthfully, I didn't care. The other possibility was that he might think this entitled him to some future favour. If he did, he would be wrong. The SN left Hubris later that day, executed the translation to the Empyrean effortlessly, and made best speed for Gudrun. Maxilla provided quarters for us all in his state apartments, but we spent most of our time on the cutter, working. Bettencourt and the servitors ran an overhaul of the ship. Loink slept. Fischig, Amos, and I worked through the paperwork on the evidence and through conjectures back and forth. I still held back what little I knew of the Pontius from Fischig, but it wouldn't be long before he started to make the connection himself. Beckwin kept herself to herself. She'd borrowed a set of fatigues from a work locker, and I saw her about the ship, reading books she'd taken from my personal library. Poetry, mostly, and some historical and philosophical works. I didn't mind. It kept her out of my way. On the third day of the voyage, I met Maxilla again, and we walked the upper promenade deck together. He seemed to enjoy telling me the histories and provenances of the Ormolu-framed paintings displayed there. We saw the occasional servitor at work, but so far there had not been the slightest glimpse of any other living crew person.
"Your friend Fischig, he is an unsubtle man," he remarked at length.
"He's no friend, and yes, he is unsubtle. Has he been asking you questions again?"
"I saw him briefly on the foredecks yesterday. He asked me if I knew a man called Eiklone. Even showed me a picture."
"And what did you say?" He flashed his pearly teeth at me.
"Now who's interrogating?"
"Forgive my imprudence." He waved a lace-cuffed hand.
"Oh, forget it. Ask anyway. Get your questions out into the open so we can clear the air."
"Very well. What did you tell him?"
"That I did not."
I nodded. "Thank you for your candour."
"But I was lying."
I turned and looked at Maxilla sharply. He was still smiling. I had the sudden horrible notion that we had all walked into a trap and dearly wished I was carrying a weapon.
"Don't worry. I lied to him because he's an arrogant runt. But I'll give you the truth of it. I would never want to put myself in the path of an imperial inquisition."
"A wise philosophy." Maxilla flopped down on a satin couch and smoothed the front of his coat.
"I was last on Thracian Primaris 2 months ago. There was talk of some cargo, and I held some meetings. The usual. And that's when this Eiklone enters the frame. Didn't call himself that, of course. Bless me, I forget the name he used. But it was him. Had others with him. A sour, tight lot. one called Kreutz, a trade envoy. He tried to have me believe your man was authorized by the Guild Synesius, but that was rubbish, even though Kreutz had the paperwork.
What did he want?
He was hiring to make a run, empty, to Gudrun, collect a cargo there and bring it to Hubris.
The nature of the cargo?
We never got that far. I turned him down. It was preposterous. He was offering a decent fee, but I knew I'd make 10 times that with my regular work.
You didn't get a contact name on Gudrun, either.
My dear Inquisitor, I'm just a shipman,
not a detective. Do you know who finally took his work?
I know who didn't. He sat forward. I happen to keep up dialogues with other masters. Seems several of us turned it down, and most for the same reason.
Which was?
It felt like trouble.
By the 5th day, my sleep patterns had begun to return to normal. Too normal, in fact, as Eichlern began to stalk my dreams again. In sleep he came to me, taunting and threatening. I don't remember much detail, except the after-image of his grinning face each time I woke. In hindsight, though Eichlern was certainly in my dreams, I don't think it was his smiling face I was remembering. The SN translated back into real space and entered the Gudrun system on the morning of the 8th day, ahead of schedule. Maxilla had boasted his ship was fast under optimum conditions, and the boast hadn't been empty. I had made arrangements with him to leave the Empyrean in the outreach of the system, considerably short of the busy local trade lanes that most arrivals to Gudrun followed. He agreed without question. It would only be a short delay.
"Who was she?"
Beckwin asked me, as we stood at an observation bay, watching the pale shape of Vibin's shrouded body slowly turn end over end as it drifted away from the SN. "A friend. A comrade," I replied.
"Is this how she wanted to go?"
she asked. "I don't think she wanted to go at all," I said. Nearby, Amos and Betancourt gazed gravely out of the thick port. Amos's expression was unreadable. Betancourt's dark face was drawn and anguished. Loink hadn't joined us, and neither had Fischig. But as I turned, I saw Maxilla standing respectfully at the rear of the observation bay, wearing a long morning coat of black silk and a short periwig with black ribbons. He moved forward as he saw me look.
"I hope I'm not intruding. My respects to your lost comrade."
I nodded my thanks. He hadn't needed to make this effort, but it seemed appropriate for the ship's master to be present during a void burial. "I'm not sure how these things are formally conducted, Maxilla," I said, "though I think this is what she would have asked for. I have spoken the Imperial Creed and the Oration of the Dead."
"Then you have done her fine service. If it is appropriate..."
He waved forward one of his gold-plated figurehead servitors, which carried a salver of glasses and a decanter.
"It is a tradition to drink a toast to the departed."
We all took a glass. "Loris Vibin," I said. A minute or so's silence followed. Then we slowly dispersed. I told Maxilla we could begin our approach run to Gudrun now, and he estimated it would take 2 hours to reach the inner system. Returning to the cutter, I found myself walking with Beckwin. She still wore the old work suit she had liberated, though somehow it seemed to enhance her beauty rather than stifle it.
"We're almost there," she said.
"Indeed.
What will my duties be?"
I had yet to explain to her what she was, or why I had recruited her. There had been ample time en route, but I had been putting it off, I suppose. I'd found time to show Amos the finery of Maxilla's staterooms and play regicide with Betancourt. I wished I could throw off my distaste at just simply being around her. I walked with her to the promenade deck and began to explain. I don't know how I expected her to take it. When she took it badly and became upset, my response was barely controlled irritation. I knew it was her nature that was making me react this way, and fought to find the sympathy she deserved. She sat weeping on a shot silk chair beneath one of the massive paintings, a hunting scene of nobles riding thoroughbred Ursidons in the chase. Every now and then she would blurt out a curse or whine a regret. It was clear she wasn't upset that I wanted to employ her. It was simply the fundamental knowledge that she was abnormal. A friendless, loveless life of woes and hard knocks suddenly had an explanation, and that explanation was her own nature. I believe that she had always, stoically, blamed the galaxy as a whole for her troubles. Now I'd as good as kick that emotional crutch away. I damned myself for not thinking the consequences through. I'd robbed her of self-esteem and what little confidence she could muster. I'd shown up her lifelong efforts to find comfort, love, and respect as hollow, self-destructive, self-denying futility. I tried to talk about the work she could do for me. She wasn't much interested. In the end, I pulled up another chair and sat next to her as she worked the painful truth through her mind. I was still sitting there when I received a vox signal. It was Maxilla.
"I wonder if you could join me on the bridge, Inquisitor. I require your assistance."
The bridge of the SN was a wide-domed chamber with floors and pillars of red-black marble. Silver servitors, immaculate and intricate as sculptures, were stationed at console positions sunk into the floor, their delicate geared arms working banks of controls set into polished mahogany fascias. The air was cool and still, and the only sound was the gentle hum and whir of the working machines. Maxilla, still dressed in his morning robes, sat in a massive leather throne overlooking the room from a marble dais. Articulated limbs extending from the rear of the throne suspended picked plates and consoles in his reach, but his attention was on the massive main observation port that dominated the front of the bridge. I strode across the floor from the entrance. Each servitor wore a mask of chased gold, fashioned into a human face of classical perfection.
"Inquisitor," Maxilla said, rising.
"Your crew are all servitors," I remarked.
"Yes," he said distractedly. "They are more reliable than pure flesh."
I made no other comment. Maxilla's relationship with the SN seemed to me akin to the way the Adeptus Mechanicus worshipped their god machines. Constant involvement with such ancient instruments had convinced them of the natural inferiority of the human species. I followed his gaze and looked at the main port. The gleaming sphere of Gudrun lay ahead, a creamy swirl of clouds stained with the lime-green phantoms of great forests under the climate cover. Clusters of black shapes thickly dotted the space between us and the planet. These were huge groups of orbiting ships, I realized. Massive dreadnoughts at high anchor, trains of great merchant ships, convoys of trade freighters streaming in under tug supervision. I had seldom seen such a wealth of orbital activity. "Is there a problem?" I asked him. He looked over at me, something like anxiety in his eyes.
"I have performed legal maneuvers and entered the trade lane approach. Gudrun Control has allocated me a high anchor buoy. All relevant data is in order and my tariffs are paid. But I have just been informed that we are to be boarded and inspected."
"This is unusual."
"It's been 10 years since anyone even suggested such a thing of my ship."
"Explanation?"
"They say security. I told you there was a founding festival underway. You can see considerable portions of Battlefleet Scarus on station. I think the military is being over-careful of its interests here just now."
"You mentioned my assistance."
"The inspection launch is on its way. I feel it would facilitate matters if they were met by a ship's master and an Imperial Inquisitor."
"I can't pull strings, Maxilla." He laughed humorlessly and looked me in the eye.
"Of course you can. But that's not what I'm asking. With an Inquisitor present, they will treat the SM with more respect. I'll not have them root through this vessel mindlessly."
I thought for a moment. This smacked of the favor I had a feeling he might call in. Worse, it stank of impropriety on his part. "I'll agree to be present for the sake of order, provided you can assure me you have nothing to hide."
"Inquisitor Eisenhorn, I—"
"Save your indignation for the inspection, Maxilla. Your assurance is all I require. If I assist you only to find you have some dirty secret or illicit cargo, you will have a great deal more to worry about than the Imperial Navy." There was a look of great disappointment on his face. Either he was a superb actor, or I had truly wounded his feelings.
"I have nothing to hide," he hissed. "I fancied you and I had become, if not friends, then decent acquaintances at least this voyage. I have shown you hospitality and freely given information into your confidence. I am hurt that you still suspect me."
"Suspicion is my business, Maxilla. If I have wronged you, my apologies.
nothing to hide," he repeated, almost to himself,
and led me off the bridge. A navy pinnace, matte grey and deeply hulled, drew alongside the massive SN and clamped itself to the fore starboard air gate. Maxilla and I were there to meet it, along with Fischig and two of the ship's primary servitors, spectacular creations of gold and silver machine parts. I'd summoned Fischig on the basis that if the sight of an Inquisitor would help, then an Arbetes Chastener would do no harm either. Betancourt was instructed to keep everyone else with the cutter. The gate locks cycled open, and the hatch jaws gaped, exhaling torrents of steam. A dozen large figures emerged through the haze. They were all dressed in the grey and black body armour of naval security, with the crest and sector symbol of Battlefleet Scarus displayed on their chests, and gold braid edging their epaulets. All were masked in form-moulded ceramite helmets, with lowered visor plates and rebreathers. They were armed with compact short-frame autoguns. The leader stepped forward, and his men grouped behind him. They didn't form a neat echelon. Messy, I thought. Casual, lacking the usual drilled discipline of the infamous naval security arm. These men were bored and going through the motions. They wanted this formality over and done, too.
"Tobias Maxilla,"
barked the leader, his voice distorted by his mask and vox amplified.
"I am Maxilla," said the ship's master, stepping forward.
"You have been notified that an inspection of your vessel is due. Furnish me with crew lists and cargo manifests. Your full cooperation is expected."
At a nod from Maxilla, one of the servitors moved forward on silent tracks and handed the security details leader a data slate with the relevant material. He didn't look at it.
"Do you have anything you wish to volunteer before the inspection begins? It will go easier for you if you make submissions of contraband."
I watched the exchange. There were 12 troops, hardly enough to search a ship the size of the SN. Where were their servitors, their scanning units, their crowbars, multi-keys and heat detectors? They had no way of knowing who I was from my appearance, but why had they not remarked on the presence of an Arbetes? My vox channel was set to the cutters. I didn't speak, but I keyed it 3 times. A non-verbal part of Glossier, Betancourt would understand. "You haven't yet identified yourself," I said. The lead security trooper turned to look at me. I saw only my reflection in his tint-coated visor.
"What?"
"You haven't identified yourself or shown your warrant of practice. It is a requirement of such inspections."
"We're naval security,"
he began angrily, stepping towards me. His men faltered. "You could be anybody." I pulled out my inquisitorial rosette. "I am Gregor Eisenhorn, Imperial Inquisitor. We will do this correctly, or not at all."
"You're Eisenhorn," he said.
There was no surprise in his voice at all. A tiny thing to notice, but enough for me. The warning was already rising in my throat as their guns came up. Chapter 8. A Dozen Killers. The Procurator. Grain Merchants from Hesperus. Maxilla uttered a yell of disbelief. The leader of the security detail and 2 of his men opened fire. Their compact autoguns were designed for shipboard fighting and zero-gravity work, low-velocity, low-recoil weapons that fired blunt-nosed slugs which couldn't puncture a hull. But they were more than capable of shredding a man. I flew myself sideways as the first shot spanged off the deck or left ugly metal bruises on the wall. In seconds it was utter chaos. All the security troopers were firing, some on semi-automatic. Smoke filled the air, and the air gate chamber was shaking with muzzle flashes and gunfire. One of Maxilla's servitors was decapitated and then punched into spare part debris as it turned towards the attackers. The other tried to move to shield Maxilla, but more shots tore out its tracks and its torso. 2 shots ripped through my trailing coat, but I made it to the doorframe behind us. I yanked my stub pistol from its holster. Fischig had drawn his own sidearm and was blasting away as he backed towards the door. He dropped one of the troopers with a tight group of shots that sent the man flying in a puff of blood. Then Fischig was lifted off his feet by a hit to the stomach. Doubled over, he tumbled into the corner of the chamber and lay still. Maxilla roared and raised his right hand. A beam of searing light spat from one of the ornate rings, and the nearest trooper exploded, burned down to scorched bone and ragged armour in his midsection. As the smouldering ruin crashed to the deck plates, the man behind him caught Maxilla in a chasing arc of automatic fire and blasted him backwards through the glass doors of an evac suit bay. The rest were charging my position. I braced and fired, placing a shot that shattered the visor of the first approaching security trooper. He fell on his face. The stub pistol, designed for concealment, had a four-shot clip, and I had a spare magazine in my coat pocket. Seven shots remained, and there were still nine of them. At least the stubber had stopping power. The clips only held four shells because they were high-caliber solids, each the size of my thumb. The short, fat muzzle of my stubber barked again, and another trooper spun sideways. I backed down the corridor, hugging the wall. The access way to the air gate was a wide, cable-lined passage, octagonal in cross-section, and lit only by deck lights. The trooper's slow, buzzing shots hissed down the hallway at me. I fired back again, but missed my target. A salvo of rounds blew out a power relay on the wall nearby in a shower of sparks. I ducked away into the shadows and found the latch handle of a shutter in the small of my back. I turned, pulled it free, and threw myself through it as a blizzard of shots impacted along the accessway wall. On the other side of the shutter, I found a narrow inspection tunnel for the air gate's main docking mechanisms. The floor was metal grill, and the tight walls were thick with networks of cables and plumper hydraulic hoses. At the end, a bare metal ladder dropped down through a floor well or up into an inspection shaft. There was no time to climb either way. The first trooper was pushing through the shutter and raising his weapon. I shot down the length of the tunnel and blew out his chest plate, and then jumped off the grill into the ladder well. 5 meters down, I slammed into a cage platform. There was only red auxiliary light down here. The troopers' visors had vision amplifiers. I was down in the guts of the vast docking clamp now, crawling between huge greased pistons and hydraulic rams the size of mature bluewood firs. Gases vented, and lubricant fluids drizzled amid dangling loops of chain. The throb of heavy-duty compressors and atmosphere regulators filled the air. I got into cover. All four red telltale lights on the stubber's grip were showing. I ejected the disposable plastic clip and slid the fresh one into place. Four green lights lit up in place of the red ones. There was noise from the ladder well. Two bulky dark shapes were moving down, backlit by the light from above. Their visors had heat enhancement too. That was clear the moment they both started firing at my position. I buried myself behind a piston unit, but a round ricocheted off the oily metal and slammed into my right shoulder, driving me forward against the deck. My face hit the grill, and it reopened the gash in my cheek, popping out several of the butterfly clips that were just beginning to get the torn flesh to knit back together. More shots rattled off the scant metal cover. Another ricochet hit the toe of my boot, and another punched into my arm, smashing my hand back against the wall behind me. The impact kicked the stubber from my grip. It bounced away across the floor, just out of reach, the four green lights taunting me. There were at least three of them out there now, moving through the confined space between machinery, firing bursts my way. I crawled on hands and knees along behind a horizontal clamp piston, low-velocity rounds pinking off the wall behind and above me. I thought about using the will, but I had no chance of getting line of sight to try any sophisticated mind trick. At the back end of the massive clamp, I found cover by the arrestor baffles and giant kinetic dampers that softened the impact of another ship against the docking arms. Greenish light filtered from a small control panel mounted in the wall between the dampers. The panel had a toughened plastic hood over it, like a public vox booth, and a glance showed me it was a test reset terminal for docking array maintenance. I tried punching several icons, but the small oval plate displayed the message, "Terminal locked out." Automatic safety measures were in place because a ship, the Naval Security Trooper's pinnace, was in the docking clamp, mated to the air gate on the deck above. I could hear scrambling above the ambient noise. The first of the troopers was clambering down the side of the clamp, following my route back to the dampers. I took out my inquisitorial rosette. It is a badge of office and a great deal more besides. A press of my thumb deployed the micro multi-key from its recess, and I slid it into the terminal's socket. It engaged. The screen blanked. My rosette had up to magenta-level imperial clearance. I prayed Maxilla had not encoded his entire ship with personal encryptions. The screen flashed again. I tapped a release order into the terminal. Dock array in active use. it told me in blunt green letters. I hit override. With a tumultuous grinding, the docking clamp disengaged. Dampers roared. Steam vented explosively. Alarms started wailing. There was an agonized scream as the trooper on my heels was gripped and then crushed from the waist down by 10 tons of expanding piston sleeve. From the deck far above, there were explosive bangs and the shriek of shearing metal. I could barely hear them above the mechanical din in the clamp chamber. When the sighing and hissing of the massive pistons died away and the venting gases reduced to a sporadic gasp, I clambered up from behind the dampers. The entire architecture of the chamber had altered, as the massive docking engines had switched from active to disengaged. 2 troopers had been crushed by the heavy gear. Another lay dead under a steam vent, brazed in his armor by a rush of superheated steam. I took up a fallen naval-issue autogun and retraced my steps. By my count, there were still 4, loose and active. I came back along the inspection tunnel and re-entered the accessway. Warning lights strobed all along the passage, and muted alarms still sounded. A figure suddenly appeared to my left. I wheeled around. It was Betancourt. He was looking straight past me, one of his elegant needle pistols aimed straight at me. He fired it twice. A distinctive stinging buzz resounded loud in my ears, and a security trooper at the far end of the passage staggered out of cover. Another shot, and the man slammed over, feet out from under him.
"Came as soon as you gave the signal," said Betancourt.
"What's your tally?"
4 so far.
"Then we're probably done. But stay sharp." I smiled at myself. Telling Midas Betancourt to stay sharp was like telling a dog to stay hairy.
"You're a mess," he told me. "What the hell happened?"
Blood ran down the side of my face from the reopened gash. I was moving awkwardly from the glancing hits to my shoulder and arm, and I was thoroughly smirched in machine oil from the docking mechanism.
"This wasn't an inspection. They were looking for me."
"Naval security?"
"I don't think so. They lacked precision and didn't know procedure."
"But they had kit, weapons, a Navy pinnace, Emperor damn them."
"That's what worries me." We went back to the airgate. An emergency shutter had come down to seal the breach when my makeshift undocking had torn the pinnace off the side of the SN. Through side ports, I could see its grey hull skewed alongside us, still attached to the clamps by one of its own docking extensors, though that was badly twisted. Its integral airgate had blown on disconnection, and at least the passenger section was open to hard vacuum. If the crew had survived, they would be in the fore section, though probably helpless. Glittering debris, scraps of metal plating, and sheared sections of extensor hung in the void outside. I checked Fischig. He was alive. His Arbites uniform was heavily laced with armor, but the short-range impacts had given him internal injuries. He was unconscious and leaking blood from the mouth. Betancourt found Maxilla beyond the shattered glass doors of the evac suit bay. He had crawled across the floor and propped himself against a harness rack. From the chest down, his rich clothes were shredded, and his legs were gone. But then, from the chest down, he wasn't human.
"So my bare facts are revealed to you after all, Inquisitor," he said, managing a smile.
I imagined he was in pain, or shock at least. To control the sophisticated bionic lower body, he had to have intricate neural linkage.
"What can I do to help you, Tobias?"
He shook his head.
"I have summoned servitors to assist me. I'll be back on my feet soon enough."
There were many questions I wanted to ask him.
Was his reconstruction the result of old injury, disease, age,
or was it, as I had a feeling, voluntary? I kept the questions to myself. They were private and didn't concern my investigation.
"I need access to your astropathic link. I need to contact Battlefleet Command and speed the closure of this matter. These men weren't a naval security detail."
"I'll instruct the bridge to provide you with the access you need. You may care to extract the inspection requests from my communication log."
That would help. I didn't think the high commanders of Battlefleet Scarus would take this lying down. I was half right, but only half. Within half an hour, I was on the bridge of the SN, surrounded by attentive servitors, reporting the incident to Battlefleet Command by confidential astropathic link. Before long, I was in vox dialogue with aides from the staff office of Admiral Lorpal Spatian, who requested that I secure the SN at its high anchor buoy and await the arrival of a security detail and an envoy from the Battlefleet Procurator. The idea of sitting tight and waiting for more troopers to arrive didn't especially appeal.
"Deserters, sir,"
Procurator Olm Madathine told me 2 hours later. He was a grizzled, narrow man with cropped grey hair and an old augmatic implant down the side of his neck under his left ear. He wore the starched white high-collared jacket, red gloves, pressed black jodhpurs and high patent leather boots of the Battlefleet Disciplinary Detachment. Madathine had been courteous from the moment he came aboard, saluting me and tucking his gold-braided white-crowned cap under his arm respectfully. His detachment of troopers were dressed and equipped identically to the ones that had boarded the SN to kill us, but from the moment of their arrival I noted their greater discipline and tight order.
"Deserters?"
Madathine seemed uneasy. He clearly disliked entanglements with an inquisitor.
"From the guard levies. You are aware a founding is presently underway on Gudrun. By order of the Lord Militant Commander, 750,000 men are being inducted into the Imperial Guard to form the 50th Gudrunite Rifles. Such is the size of the founding, and the fact that this is notably the 50th regiment assembled from this illustrious world, that a planet-wide celebration and associated ceremonial military events are taking place."
"And these men deserted?" Madathine delicately drew me to one side as his troopers carried the corpses of the insurgents from the vicinity of the airgate and bagged them. I had set Betancourt to watch over them.
"We have had trouble,"
he confided quietly.
"The muster was originally to have been 500,000, but the Lord Militant Commander increased the figure a week prior to the founding. He is prepared for a crusade in the Ophidian subsector, and, well, many found themselves conscripted with little notice. Between you and me, the great festivities are partly an attempt to draw attention from the matter. There's been some rioting in barracks at the founding area, and desertion. It's been busy for us."
"I can well imagine. You know for certain these men are deserters from the guard?" He nodded and handed me a data slate. On it was a list of 12 names, linked to file biographies and blurry hollow portraits.
"They absconded from founding barracks 74 outside Dorset yesterday, took uniforms and weapons from the bursary at the orbital port and stole a pinnace. No one thought to challenge a squad of naval security troopers."
"And no one questioned their lack of credentials and flight codes?"
"Regrettably, the pinnace had been preloaded with a course plan and transponder codes to take it into the fleet anchorage. They would have been discovered long since had that not been the case. They were clearly looking for a non-military starship like this."
"These are regular draftees. Infantrymen."
"Yes."
"Who could fly a pinnace?"
"The ringleader,"
he referred back to the slate,
"one Jono Lingard, was a qualified orbital pilot, worked on the ferries. As I said, a regrettable combination of events."
I wasn't going to let this go. Madathine wasn't lying, I was certain of that, but the information he was presenting me with was full of gaps and inconsistencies. "What about the demand for the inspection?"
"That came from the pinnace itself. Entirely unofficial. They spotted your ship and improvised. We have sourced the inspection demand to the pinnace's vox log."
"No," I said. He took a step backwards, alert to the anger that was growing in me.
"Sir?"
"I have checked the SN's communication log. It doesn't tell me the origin of the signals, but it shows the inspection demand came via astropathic link, not vox. The pinnace had no astropath." "This is the same astropathic link that allocated the SN its high anchor buoy. That's been shown as authentic enough, and these men were looking for me. Me, Procurator. To kill me. They knew my name." He went pale and seemed unable to find a reply. I turned away from him. "I don't know who these men are. They may indeed have been guard draftees, but someone set them on this course to find me. Someone who covered their movements, provided materials and transport, and authenticated their business with this ship. Someone either in the Battlefleet or with an outrageous amount of access to its workings. No other explanation fits."
"You're talking of a conspiracy."
"I am no stranger to underhand behavior, Madathine. Nor am I unduly perturbed by attempts on my life. I have enemies. I expect such things. This shows me my enemies are even more powerful than I suspected.
My lord, I...
What is your level of seniority, Procurator?
I'm grade one, magenta cleared. Enjoying equivalency with the rank of Fleet Commodore. I answer directly to Lord Procurator Humboldt.
I knew this from his shoulder flashes, but I wanted to hear him tell me. Of course. Your superior wouldn't have trusted such a delicate matter to a junior officer, nor did he want to show disrespect to me. I trust this matter is still held in the highest confidence.
Sir, yes, sir. The Lord Procurator recognized its delicacy. Besides, notices of any infractions are being suppressed by order of the Lord Militant Commander, so as not to foment further unrest. The details of this incident are known only to myself and my squad here, the Lord Procurator and his senior aides.
Then I'd like to keep it that way. I'd like my enemies to believe, for as long as possible, that this assassination attempt was successful. Can I rely on your cooperation, Procurator?
Of course, Inquisitor.
You will take an encrypted message back to your Lord Procurator from me. It will appraise him of the situation and my requirements. I will also supply you with a covert vox link with which to contact me if any further information becomes available. Any further information, Madathine, even if you don't believe I will find it relevant. He nodded keenly again. I didn't add the codicil that if I found this confidence broken, I would come after him, the senior aides, and the Lord Procurator himself, like the wrath of Rogel Dorn. He could figure that out for himself. After Madathine and his crew had left the SN, I turned to Betancourt.
What now?
He asked. How does it feel to be dead, Midas? We left the SN at midnight aboard the Guncutter. Fischig, conscious now, remained aboard Maxilla's ship, recovering from his punishing wounds in the SN's spectacularly equipped auto-infirmary. Maxilla had agreed to keep the SN at anchor for the time being. I had arranged to cover all revenues he stood to lose. I felt I might need a reliable ship at a moment's notice, and it also made sense that if the SN suddenly departed, it would weaken the cover story that we were all dead. I talked it over with Maxilla in the bridge chamber. He sat in his great throne, sipping Amasek, while reconstruction servitors painstakingly restructured his lower limbs.
"I'm sorry you are now so involved, Tobias."
"I'm not," he said. "This has been the most interesting run I've made in a long time."
"You're prepared to stay until I give you word?"
"You're paying well, Inquisitor," he laughed at this. "In truth, I am content to help you serve the Emperor. Besides, that Ophishig needs better care than your cutter's dingy medical suite can provide, and I can assure you I won't be running off anywhere until he's safely off my ship."
I left the bridge, almost charmed by Maxilla's generous spirit. There could be many reasons why he assisted me so willingly, fear of the Inquisition being the chief one. But in truth, I was certain that it was because he had rediscovered the pleasure of interaction with other humans. It was there in his eagerness to talk, to show off his art treasures, to help, to accommodate. He had been alone in the company of machines for too long. Betancourt changed the transponder codes of the Guncutter as we left the SN's hold. We kept a number of alternative craft identifiers in the codifier memory. For the past few months, and during the stopover at Hubris, we had run as an official transport of the Inquisition, making no attempt to hide our nature. Now we were a trade delegation from Sameter, specializing in gene-fixed cereal crops, hoping to interest Gudrun's noble estates in easy-maintenance, pest-free crops, now that the Founding had drained their labor pool. Betancourt voxed Gudrun Control, identified us, and requested route and permission for landfall at Dorsay, the northern capital. They obliged us without hesitation. Another greedy trader in town for the festival. We swept down through the vast elements of Battlefleet Scarus at high anchor. Rows of grotesque, swollen-bellied troopships, massive destroyers with jutting prow rams and proud Aquila emblems. The vast battleships of the line, cold, grey, orthogonal giants of space, blistered with weapon emplacements. Barbed frigates, long and lean and cruel as wood wasps, schools of fighter craft, running the picket. Post-orbital space was seething with transports, scudding tugs, resupply launches, merchant cutters, bulky service lifters, and skeletal loading platforms. Away to starboard, the mixed echelons of the merchant ships, the bulk freighters, the sleek sprint traders, the supermassive guild ships, the hybrid rogues. The SN was out there somewhere, winking boy lights, describing the stacks and levels of the anchor stations, filled the night, another constellation blocking out the real starfield. Betancourt nursed us down through the traffic, down into the crystal-bright ionosphere, down into the opalescent ranges of the high clouds. We were heading across the crossover from night to day as the planet turned, making for Dorset, where dawn was coming up on another day of the Festival of Founding. Chapter 9. At Dorset. Market Forces. In Pursuit of Tannock Bray. Dorset wasn't waking up. It had been awake all night. Vox horns along the old streets, avenues and canals broadcast martial themes, and streamers and pennants flew from every available surface. I had speed-read Amos's summation of the planet. Gudrun, capital of the Helican subsector. Scarus sector, segmentum obscurus. Boasting a human culture for 3,500 years, feudally governed by powerful noble houses whose reach and power extended across 36 other worlds in the Helican subsector. Thracian Primaris, that vast bloated hub of industry and commerce, was the most populated and productive world in the region, but Gudrun was the cultural and administrative heart. And it was reckoned the combined wealth of the noble houses rivaled the commercial worth of the output of the Thracian hives. Seen from our approach run, Dorset gleamed white in the dawn. It lay on the coast, around the lip of a sea-fed lagoon, straddling the mighty river Drunna. From the cutter's ports as we turned in, we could see the white specks of sailboats out in the lagoon basin. Beyond the vast white spread of the city, I could see massive stockades and emplacements established in the rolling green hills and bluffs, temporary barracks for the founding regiment. Betancourt set us down at Jehovah Field, the municipal port serving Dorset. It was built on a long, narrow island in the lagoon facing the city, and the space premium meant smaller ships like ours were lowered on monotasked, heavy elevators and berthed in a honeycomb of compartments drilled into the porous lava rock of the island's heart. Loink stayed with the cutter. Midas, Amos, Beckwin and myself prepared to go into Dorset. We changed into simple, anonymous clothing. Dark blue robes for Amos, plain black suits of good cloth and long leather coats for Betancourt and myself, and a long gown of porcelain blue crepe with a cream-lace shawl for Elizabeth Beckwin. Betancourt, with some reluctance, had reopened Vibben's possessions to find clothing suitable for Beckwin. She didn't seem to mind that their former owner was dead. Under red awnings fluttering in the dawn breeze, the island jetties were thick with passengers waiting for transport to the mainland. We queued among groups of merchants, visiting dignitaries and fleet ratings on furlough. Busking musicians and peddlers plied the captive audience. At length, we hired one of the grav skiffs lining up at the jetty. It was a long, spear-tip-shaped airboat with a glossy violet hull. Open-topped, it provided seats for six, with the steersman perched high at the aft over the bulbous anti-grav generators. It slid us across the lagoon, keeping 2 meters above the choppy, dappled water. Dorset rose before us. Now, on its level, we could appreciate how majestic, how towering the city was. Rising above the water on stilts formed of vast basalt stacks and pillars, the buildings were constructed from smoothly fitted cyclopean stone blocks, their facades lime-washed, their shallow roofs dressed with verdigreed copper tiles. Gargoyles yawned at gutter ends or curled around downpipes and drain sluices. Upper stories had balconies with railings made of tarnished copper. Many balconies also had canopies. Arched stone bridges and metal stairwalks linked neighbouring buildings, sometimes across the water-filled streets themselves. Along the canal side, stone walkways formed a water-level street for pedestrians. And there were many of those. The place was alive with movement, colour and noise. Once we got into the city proper, our passage down the canals was slowed by other grav skiffs, water buses, private yawls and motor-driven boats. Above us, at high traffic levels, speeders and atmospheric flyers buzzed back and forth. Everywhere we looked were banners celebrating Battlefleet Scarus and the Gudrunite Guard regiments, especially the 50th Rifles. Amos chattered to himself as usual, noting the elements of Dorset into his wrist slate, his hunger for accumulating knowledge unstinted. I watched him for a while, his nervous moves, his boyish glee at new details, his obsessive-compulsive tapping at his slate. The keypads of that battered old slate were worn smooth. Midas Betancourt was alert and sharp as always. He sat in the front of the grav skiff, soaking up details like Amos. But the details he noticed would be far more pertinent and immediately useful than my old savant's. Beckwin simply sat back and smiled, the chop of the breeze fluttering her shawl. I doubted she could ever have come here under her own steam. Gudrun was the epicenter of the sub-sector culture, the big bright world she had always dreamed about, and of which she yearned to be a part. I let her have her fun. There would be hard work later. We took a suite of rooms at the Dorset Regency. I considered it expedient to have a base of operations on the mainland. Betancourt drilled out the door frames with a hand tool and installed locator bolts with built-in flash deterrents. We also wired the internal doorways. The house servitors were given strict instructions not to enter when we were absent. I stood in the heavy, lime-washed balcony, under a faded awning of purple canvas, and listened to the march of the adeptees as it played out, distorted, from the speaker horns that dressed the street. The canal below was thick with traffic. I saw a skiff overladen with drunken guardsmen, all wearing their newly issued red and gold kits. Men of the 50th Gudrunite Rifles, raising hell and risking death by drowning as they enjoyed their last hours on their homeworld. In a few days they would be packed into a troopship and bound for who knew what horror, a sub-sector away. One of them fell into the canal as they tried to stagger ashore. His comrades dredged him out and baptized his head with the contents of a liquor bottle. Amos joined me and showed me a data slate map.
"The Regal Bonded Merchant Guild of Synesius," he said. "Headquarters are 5 streets away."
Guild Synesius owns some of the most imposing premises in the commercial district of Dorset. A spur of the Grand Canal actually fed in under the coloured glass portico of the main buildings, so that visiting traders could run their skiffs inside and disembark under cover in a tiled and carpeted reception dock. Our grav skiff carried us in, and we stepped out amid clusters of tall, thin, gowned traders from Messina, merchants from Samita in ludicrously heavy hats and veils, and obese bankers from the Thracian hives. I strode ashore and turned to offer Beckwin my hand. She nodded courteously as she left the skiff. I hadn't briefed her much. The aristocratic airs and graces were her own spontaneous invention. Though I still loathed her, I admired her more with each passing moment. She was playing things perfectly.
"Your name and business here, sire? Madame?"
a Guild Synesius chamberlain asked as he approached us. He was dripping in finery, gold-brocaded gowns attiring every servant in the place. Augmetic implants blistered in place of his ears, and he clutched a slate and stylus. "My name is Farchival, a merchant from Hesperus. This is Lady Farchival. We come to tender grain contracts with the high houses of this world, and we are told Guild Synesius will provide us the necessary brokerage."
"Do you have a guild responser, sire?"
"Of course. My contact was Simon Croats."
"Croats?"
The chamberlain paused.
"Oh, Gregor, I'm so bored," Beckwin suddenly announced. "This is so very slow and dull. I want to cruise the canals again. Why can't we go back and deal with those spirited fellows at Guild Mensurae?"
"Later, my dearest," I said, delighted and wrong-footed by her improvisation.
"You have already visited another guild?"
the chamberlain asked quickly.
"They were very nice. They brought me Solian tea," Beckwin purred. "Let me escort you both," the chamberlain said at once. "Simon Croats is, of course, one of our most valued envoys. I will arrange an audience for you forthwith. In the meantime, please relax in this suite. I will have Solian tea sent up directly."
"And Nafar biscuits?"
cooed Beckwin.
"But of course, madame."
He swept out and closed the double doors of the luxurious waiting room behind him. Beckwin looked at me and giggled. I confess, I laughed out loud. What got into you?
You said we were moneyed merchants who expected the very best. I was just earning my salary.
Keep it up, I said. We looked around the room. Gauze-draped windows 10 meters high looked out over the Grand Canal, but they were insulated to keep the noise out. Rich tapestries dressed the walls between Sameter School oils that Maxilla would have loved to own. A burnished servitor brought in a tray of refreshments soon after that. It lowered it onto a marble-topped occasional table and trundled out.
"Solian tea," Bequin squeaked,
lifting the lid of the porcelain pot.
"And Nafar biscuits,"
she added with a smile, through the crumbs of the first one. She poured me a cup, and I stood by the fireplace, sipping it, striking an appropriately haughty pose. The guild representative flew in through the doors a moment later. He was a small, spiky-haired man with flowing gowns and far too much jewellery. The guild Synesius brandmark was proudly displayed on his forehead. He was, the brand indicated, property. His name was Marcellus.
"Sire Farcheval, madam, had I known you were visiting, I would have cancelled meats to be here. Forgive my tardiness."
"I forgive it," I said. "But I'm afraid Lady Farcheval may be fast losing her patience." Bequin yawned on cue.
"Oh, that is not good. Not good at all."
Marcellus clapped his hands, and servitors trundled in.
"Provide the lady with whatever she requests,"
Marcellus told them.
Vorder leaves?" she said.
"At once,"
Marcellus instructed.
"And a plate of birri truffles, sautéed in wine?"
I winced.
"At once, at once,"
Marcellus yelped, shushing the servitors out of the room. I stepped forward and put down my cup.
"I'll be straight with you, sir. I represent grain merchants on Hesperus, a significant cartel of grain merchants."
I handed him my holodent. It was fake, of course. Betancourt and Amos had run it up, using Amos's profound knowledge in general and his knowledge of Hesperus, gleaned from interviews with Maxilla in particular. Marcellus seemed impressed enough by my identification.
"What sort of size cartel are we talking about, sire?"
"The entire Western continent."
"And you offer?"
I produced a sample tube from my pocket. "A gene-fixed strain of cereal that could be easily managed by many of your landowners now that their workforce is depleted. It is indeed a wonder." The servitors reappeared, delivering Bequin's delicacies. As she munched the soft-fleshed birri, she said,
"The other guilds are bidding for this product, mister. I do hope Guild Synesius won't miss out."
Marcellus shook the sample tube and looked at it.
"Is this,"
he said, his voice dropping,
"Xenos cultured?"
"Would that be a problem?" I asked.
"No, sire, not officially. The Inquisition is, of course, very tight about such things, but that is precisely why we offer these discreet interviews. The entire guild buildings are buffered against trackers, intercept beams, and vox thieves."
"I am pleased to hear it. So a Xenos-cultured cereal strain would not be hard to market?"
"Naturally not. There are collective enterprises eager for assured crop yields, especially those hot-housed by alien technology."
"Good," I lied. "But I want the best return. Saemon told me that House Glaw should be the first to approach."
"Saemon?"
"Saemon Croats? The Guild Synesius envoy I dealt with on Hesperus?"
"Quite so. You wish me to arrange a trade meeting with House Glaw?"
"I think that's what I said, didn't I?" We left the Guild Synesius dock 20 minutes later. Bequin was still licking her lips from the birri. As soon as our skiff was clear of the building, the vox-seaver woven into my cuff began to twitch. "Eisenhorn?" It was Loink.
"I've just accepted a message from Tobias Maxilla. Do you want me to relive it?"
"Just a summary, Loink."
"He says the ship that took Iclone's Gudrun Hubris run is at anchor here. Says he's done some probing. The rogue trader Scavaler. The master, one Ephries Tannockbray, is already planetside."
"Signal Maxilla and thank him for his work, Loink," I said. The identity of Iclone's mysterious starship was now known to me. We were taking lunch at a commercial tavern overlooking the Bridge of Carnadons, when Marcellus sent Sire Farcheval a private text message by Vox drone. The drone, an oblate metal unit roughly the size of a small citrus fruit, came buzzing into the dining terrace like a pollen insect, scudding from table to table at head height on its tiny repeller motors until it found me. Then it hovered, chimed, and beamed its holographic cargo against the side of my crystal tumbler, the crest of Guild Sinesias, followed by a formal and obsequious text inviting Sire Farcheval and his entourage to a meeting at the Glore Estate the following afternoon. We were to meet Marcellus at the Guild building at 4, where transport would be waiting. The drone continued to project the message until I broke the beam with a wave of my hand and made a quick verbal assent, which it recorded. Dismissed, it bumbled away with its answer.
"How did it find us?" asked Beckwin.
"A pheromonal trace," Amos replied. "The Guild building's master systems will have sampled you both during your visit, and then it would have come searching until it matched the record in its sensors."
Vox drone messaging was common practice on higher-tech imperial worlds like this. It gave me an idea.
"You say the Guild seemed comfortable dealing with Xenos material,"
Betancourt was saying, raising his wineglass to sip. I nodded.
"We'll concentrate on House Glore for now. That's where our primary interest lies. But I'm not going to forget Sinesius. When we're done, the full weight of the Inquisition will come to bear on their dealings."
Beckwin was looking out at the fine ornamental bridge that arched over the Drunner below.
"What are those creatures?" she asked.
"The stone effigies of great quadruped predators decorated each span of the old crossing. The beasts were huge, with powerful mastiff-like builds, brush tails and long snouts, bristling with tusks."
"Carnadons," Amos said,
once again delighted to be able to share his considerable knowledge.
"The heraldic animal of Gudrun. They feature in many crests and emblems hereabouts, symbolizing the noble authority of the world. Rare now, of course, hunted to near extinction. I believe only a few live wild now in the northern tundra."
"We have a day at our disposal," I told them, cutting through the idle talk. "Let's use it well. Let's find this shipmaster, Tanakbray." Betancourt raised his eyebrows and was about to tell me how difficult that was going to be, until I explained my idea to him. We used a clerical bureau on a water street off the Ooskin Canal and paid for a Vox drone message. I kept it simple, a brief inquiry to the master of the rogue trader Scavola concerning the possibility of off-planet passage. The cleric serving me took my text and payment without comment, and loaded the message into one of the 36 Vox drones that lay inert in a rack behind his seat. Then he accessed his data files, retrieved the pheromone trace for Tanakbray that the shipmaster had logged with the city administration at immigration, and installed that too. The selected drone rose, buzzed, and floated away out of the office. On the street outside, Betancourt fired up the motor of the airbike he had rented and made off after it. Chances were it would lead us to our quarry. If it gave Betancourt the slip, there was every reason to hope Tanakbray would come to us. He was a commercial merchant looking for business, after all. Amos, Beckwin, and I followed in a public grav skiff, staying in Vox contact with Betancourt. The canal traffic was thicker than ever, and local Arbites, as well as naval security details, were out in force. There was to be a major ceremonial cavalcade later that afternoon, and the route was being prepared. Already crowds of spectators were gathering on the bridges and the walkways. Banners and well-wishing garlands were on display all around. Betancourt was waiting for us on a walkway in the Terskold Quarter, a part of Dorset famous for its taverns and clubs. I left Amos and Beckwin in the skiff.
"In there,"
he said, indicating an old, bow-fronted establishment.
"I followed it inside. It delivered to the 5th table from the left. Tanakbray is the tall man in the rose-red jacket. He has 2 men with him, by my count."
"Stay back and be ready," I said. The tavern was dark and crowded. Music and lights pulsed from the low roof, and the air was rank with the smells of sweat, smoke, hops, and the unmistakable fumes of obscura. My Vox drone was coming out through the door as I entered. It paused, delivered its message, and then drifted away. A curt text informed me that the Scavaler was not for hire. Moving through the packed clientele, I located Tanakbray. His rose-red jacket was of finest silk, and his frizzy black hair was raked back into twists and tied with ribbons at the back of his head. He had a craggy, singularly unwelcoming face. His drinking companions were a pair of common crewmen in studded leather body gloves. "Master Tanakbray?" He looked round at me, slowly, and said nothing. His comrades fixed me with grim stares. Perhaps we could talk privately, I suggested. Perhaps you could piss off. I sat down anyway. His men seemed astonished at my action and stiffened. All Tannock Bray had to do was nod, I realized. Let me start with an easy question, I began. Start by pissing off, he replied. He was now fixing me with a caustic gaze. Without breaking eye contact, I noticed that his left hand was inside his coat. You seem anxious. Why is that? No answer. His men stirred nervously. Something to hide? I'm having a quiet drink. I don't want interruptions. Now sod off. So unfriendly. Well, if these gentlemen aren't going to give us privacy, I'll press on regardless. I do hope I don't embarrass you. Who the hell are you? Now I didn't reply. My eyes never left his. Your high anchor fees are delinquent, I said at last. That's a lie. It was, and so was what I said next. It didn't matter. The purpose was to undermine him. And your manifest papers are incomplete. Gudrun Control may wish to impound your ship until the irregularities are cleared up. Lying bastard. It's an easy matter. You made a run to Hubris that is not logged, nor is any cargo list filed. How will they calculate import duties? His chair scraped back a